Robert's feeling.
Today is Wednesday, December 15th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, NATO rejects call by Moscow for a moratorium on intermediate-range nuclear missiles in Europe.
But we have now seen the demise of this treaty because Russia violated the treaty by deploying new intermediate-range nuclear-capable missiles in Europe.
Plus, UN warns of acute hunger in Afghanistan as winter looms.
She says it's an avalanche of hunger and destitution. An estimated 98% of Afghans are not consuming enough food.
Also, a positive COVID-19 test among U.S. Secretary of State Blinken's traveling party cuts short his tour of Southeast Asia. Our top story today is in Brussels. NATO on Tuesday rejected a call by Moscow for a moratorium on the deployment of intermediate-range nuclear missiles in Europe, saying Russia itself had violated INF treaty for years. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg told reporters in Brussels that Russia's call for a moratorium would not be credible unless Moscow destroys all its SSC-8 missiles. Stoltenberg was referring to the 1987 INF treaty between the then Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev and U.S. President Ronald Reagan that banned intermediate-range nuclear weapons, those with a range of 500 to 5,500 kilometers in Europe.
For many years, we had a ban on all intermediate-range weapons, banning, of course, intermediate-range missiles in Europe. That was the INF Treaty agreed back in 1987. But we have now seen the demise of this treaty because Russia violated the treaty by deploying new intermediate-range nuclear-capable missiles in Europe. They have done that for many years, and that led to the demise of the treaty banning all intermediate-range weapons. So the proposal from Russia on a moratorium is not credible because we had a ban and they violated that ban. So unless Russia, in a verifiable way, destroys all its SSC-8 missiles, which are those missiles that violated the INF treaty, it is not credible when they now pose a ban on something they actually have already started to deploy.
That's NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. A UN Human Rights Council debate on Ukraine Wednesday drifted into criticism of Russia's heavy military buildup along the Ukrainian border. US and British representatives voiced support for Ukraine, while a Russian diplomat ignored the issue. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The debate in Geneva was called to discuss the human rights situation in Ukraine. The UN Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights, Nada Al-Nashif, presented a carefully balanced report on civic space and fundamental freedoms in the country. She criticized the Ukrainian government for restricting the free expression of critical opinion in the media, as well as attacks against opposition political parties. She then pivoted to the self-proclaimed republics in eastern Ukraine, backed by the Russian government. She criticized the lack of freedom of expression and condemned the arbitrary detention of social media users for expressing their views online. Her most vociferous criticisms were aimed at Russia and its illegal occupation of the Autonomous Republic of Crimea and the city of Sevastopol.
We continue to document violations of international human rights and international humanitarian law. Journalists who expressed dissenting or critical views were subjected to surveillance, criminal prosecution, arrests, prohibition of entry into Crimea, and deportation from Crimea.
Al-Nashif did not touch upon the buildup of about 100,000 Russian troops amassed at the Ukrainian border. But that topic stimulated a heated debate among nations attending the council session. Britain's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Simon Manley, said his country was monitoring the situation in Ukraine closely.
Russia's activity poses a threat to Ukraine's and international security. We stand with our allies to defend the frontiers of freedom. And we call on Russia to bring an end to its threatening and destabilizing behavior and to respect and protect the human rights of people living in illegally annexed Crimea and non-government-controlled eastern Ukraine.
Ukraine's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Yevhenia Filipenko, echoed these fears.
If Russia does not de-escalate its current large-scale military build-up along the Ukrainian border, the impact of possible invasion will have disastrous consequences for security, humanitarian and human rights situation in my country and well beyond.
U.S. Human Rights Officer Patrick Elliott gave assurances of Washington's unwavering support of Ukraine's sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity. First Secretary of the Russian Permanent Mission in Geneva, Yaroslav Eremin, did not respond to any of these criticisms. Instead, he expressed concern about Ukraine's closure of Russia's language channels and the stigmatization of people working for Russian language media. He urged the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights to stop including in its reports matters related to Russian regions. Belarus was the only country to ally itself with Russia. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Relations between Russia and China reached a new level, Russian President Vladimir Putin told Chinese President Xi Jinping on Wednesday, as the leaders met via video link. They also discussed tensions in Europe and what the Kremlin called, quote, aggressive, unquote, U.S. and NATO rhetoric. The conversation took place at a moment of high tension in both countries' relationship with the West, with Beijing under pressure over human rights and Moscow by its buildup of troops near the border with Ukraine. Russia had cultivated closer ties with China as its relations with the West have worsened, and Putin had used the partnership to balance U.S. influence while striking lucrative deals, especially on energy. He and Xi this year agreed to extend a 20-year friendship and cooperation treaty. Their discussions took place 8 days after a Russia-U.S. video call in which U.S. President Joe Biden warned Putin against invading Ukraine, and Putin told him Russia needed legally binding security guarantees from the West. The UN's World Food Program says almost all Afghans do not have enough to eat, and a failing economy could tip Afghanistan's increasingly dire situation under Taliban rule into catastrophe next year. WFP surveys showed an estimated 98% of Afghans are not eating enough, an agency spokesman said on Tuesday. The abrupt withdrawal of foreign aid following the Taliban victory in August has left Afghanistan's economy on the brink of collapse, with prices for food, fuel, and other basic needs rising rapidly out of reach of many. WFP spokesperson Thompson Peary said at a Geneva briefing, the agency has a huge amount to do to stop this crisis from becoming a catastrophe. The WFP has provided food assistance to 50 million Afghans so far in 2021. Next year, plans to ramp up its assistance to 23 million people across all provinces in Afghanistan.
Country director describes the situation as quite dire. She says it's an avalanche of hunger and destitution. An estimated 98% of Afghans are not consuming enough food, which is a worrisome 17% increase since August. Now, the spiraling economic crisis, the conflict and drought has meant the average family can now barely cope. Families are resorting to desperate measures as the bitter winter sets in. 9 in every 10 families are now buying less expensive food, which tends to be less nutritious. They do not like it. It's less preferred, but they are food insecure and have no choice. 8 in 10 are eating less, and 7 in 10 are borrowing food in order to get by. So what this then happens is that they continue to sink deeper and deeper into the poverty and debt trap. We cannot waste any moment. We cannot waste any opportunity to ramp up. So indeed, 15 million Afghans received WFP food assistance in 2021, but a massive uplift is needed as economy disintegrates. The United Nations World Food Program is rapidly ramping up humanitarian operations in Afghanistan to assist more than 23 million people facing severe hunger in the country in 2022 as inflation and currency depreciation make it even more difficult to feed themselves.
That's WFP spokesperson Thompson Peary. The Afghan survivors of a mistaken U.S. drone strike say they are frustrated that no one will be punished for the attack. Associated Press correspondent Rita Foley reports.
The Hellfire missile slammed into Zemarai Amadi's car, killing him and 9 relatives, including 7 children, in the chaotic final days of the U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. General Frank McKenzie, head of U.S. Central Command, called the strike a tragic mistake. But 3 of Amadi's brothers, sitting just a few feet from where the missile struck in August, say they've heard nothing from Washington about financial compensation or whether they might be evacuated to keep them safe from criminals who are threatening them. To try to get the money, many people think the U.S. has already paid them. John Kirby, chief Pentagon spokesman, says the U.S. is ready to pay the Amadi's compensation and potentially get them out of Afghanistan. But he says the U.S. wants it done as safely as possible. I'm Rita Foley.
The Senate voted to raise the debt ceiling by $2.5 trillion, avoiding a default. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
On this vote, the yeas are 50, the nays are 49, and the joint resolution is passed.
The Senate approved legislation to lift the nation's debt limit Tuesday under a deal struck by party leaders. The measure increases the debt limit by $2.5 trillion until after next year's midterm elections. The party line vote came just one day ahead of a deadline set by Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, who had warned she was running out of options to avoid what would be the nation's first ever default. The measure now goes to the House, where approval is needed before it goes to President Joe Biden's desk for his signature. Mike Gracia, Washington.
A federal judge has dismissed a lawsuit brought by former President Donald Trump in his attempt to block congressional lawmakers from obtaining his tax returns. U.S. District Judge Trevor McFarland on Tuesday ruled that the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee has broad authority and the Treasury Department should provide the tax returns to the committee. Again, AP correspondent Mark Gracia reports.
Former President Donald Trump has been dealt a legal setback in his bid to keep his tax returns from congressional scrutiny. U.S. District Judge Trevor McFadden has ruled the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee has broad authority and the Treasury Department should provide the Trump tax returns to the committee. McFadden, a former Justice Department official and Trump appointee, wrote in his ruling, even if the former president is right on the facts, he is wrong on the law. The committee wants access to Trump's personal and business tax returns from 2013 through 2018. The judge stayed his ruling for 2 weeks, giving Trump's legal team time to file an appeal. Mike Gracia, Washington.
A positive COVID-19 test among U.S. Secretary of State Blinken's traveling party has caught shot the top diplomat's first official tour of Southeast Asia. A member of the press corps accompanying Blinken on what was to have been a 3-day nation visit to Indonesia, Malaysia, and Thailand tested positive for the coronavirus on Wednesday in Kuala Lumpur, forcing Blinken to abandon the program at his next and last stop in Bangkok and return to the United States. Instead of spending Wednesday night in Bangkok, the State Department said Blinken will fly to the Thai capital for a very brief logistical layover before traveling to Guam to refuel and then continue on to Hawaii. The disfiguring disease Noma, found mainly in poor areas of sub-Saharan Africa that lack health care, kills 90% of victims, most of them children, when left untreated. Noma is preventable, and to that end, aid groups are urging the World Health Organization to add Noma to its list of neglected tropical diseases. Henry Wilkins reports from Congous, Burkina Faso.
8-year-old Amadou Compaoré recently recovered from Noma, a little-known tropical disease. Although Noma has scarred his face, Amadou, relatively speaking, is one of the lucky ones. If Noma is diagnosed within the first few weeks of infection, it's easily treatable with a course of antibiotics. His father, Sibiri Compaoré, told VOA he noticed the disease in the run-up to Christmas. To begin with, Amadou said his mouth ached to the point where he couldn't eat anymore. He even had great difficulty drinking sachets of water. Compaoré took his son to the nearest city, Kaya, about 25 kilometres away, where medical staff were able to identify the disease thanks to awareness building by the Swiss non-governmental organisation Sentinels. Sidi Omar Boena is a nurse at the Sentinels Medical Centre in Ouagadougou, specialising in the treatment of Noma.
Parce que la plupart de nos agents de santé au Burkina ici, beaucoup ignorent la maladie de Noma.
He says most health workers in Burkina Faso have not heard of the disease Noma and that diagnosing it in people 400 to 500 kilometres from Ouagadougou is very difficult. He says that he's sometimes forced to diagnose Noma with photos sent to him by WhatsApp. Odette Seren, who also suffered from NOMA, now receives regular follow-up treatment at the Sentinels Clinic, including support in finding a job. She now works as a tailor, but she says people still laugh at her, which makes her sad. She says Boena has done a lot to take care of her, however. NOMA is just one of many illnesses currently missing from the World Health Organization's list of neglected tropical diseases. Doctors Without Borders, a medical NGO, is running a campaign to have NOMA added to the WHO list, which already includes diseases like rabies and dengue fever. Claire Gentette is the director of the NOMA campaign for Doctors Without Borders.
At community level, because there is, of course, discrimination affecting the patients. And so every time there is a case, we might not even be aware because they are hidden by the communities or they are dying. More than 90% of people are estimated to die.
The WHO says when it adds diseases to the list, factors like social stigma and death rates are taken into consideration. The WHO says resources are limited, so some diseases have to be left off. WHO press officer Ashok Molu explains the effect of adding a disease to the list.
It really brings the disease or the condition to another level. It also adds to the advocacy part of the disease, awareness creation, and also resources.
As for Amadou Compaoré, he says what the doctors have done to help him has been an inspiration. Compaoré says he wants to become a doctor, to treat people so that they can be cured, like him. The WHO plans to make possible new additions to its neglected tropical disease list in 2023. It remains to be seen if NOMA will be among them. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Kongusi, Burkina Faso.
This is the Voice of America. A South African court has ordered that former President Jacob Zuma should go back to prison after withdrawing the medical parole given to him earlier this year. Zuma was released from prison in September after serving about 2 months of his 50-month sentencing for defying a constitutional court order that he should testify before a state commission investigating allegations of corruption when he was president from 2009 to 2018. On Wednesday, the Gauteng High Court in Pretoria ruled that the medical parole granted to Zuma was illegal and he should go back to prison. Firefighters in Hong Kong have rescued hundreds of people who fled to the rooftop of a skyscraper and became trapped there after a large fire broke out. Authorities said blaze started in the early afternoon Wednesday at the World Trade Center in the city's popular Causeway Bay shopping district. The 38-story tower houses both offices and a shopping mall. At least 13 people were sent to the hospital. Authorities say firefighters had likely put out the fire by late afternoon and suspected the blaze started on buildings' bottom floors. You are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Afo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. After almost 2 years of strict COVID-19 controls, Australia has reopened its borders to skilled migrants, students and backpackers. Australia banned most foreign nationals in March 2020 under some of the world's toughest coronavirus restrictions. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Holders of various working and student visas are now allowed into Australia without requiring an exemption if they're fully vaccinated. Japanese and South Korean nationals are also permitted into the country. Australia had already relaxed travel restrictions to allow the return of citizens, permanent residents and their families. All arrivals will have to follow the quarantine rules of the state or territory to which they travel. There are no entry restrictions on travellers entering the states of New South Wales and Victoria. However, international passengers need government approval to travel to Western Australia. Industries across the country, from agriculture to hospitality, that rely on short-term workers have been struggling to find staff since the country closed its borders in March 2020. They hope the reopening of Australia's international borders will ease the worker shortage. Universities are also preparing to welcome back overseas students. Yongjin Liu has arrived from Hong Kong to study at the University of New South Wales.
It's actually a mixed feeling of very exciting, but also because everything is new here. And this is my first time to live in a foreign country, so a little bit nervous.
It's also so-called Freedom Day for the unvaccinated in the state of New South Wales, where many restrictions will end for those who've not been inoculated. New South Wales Health Minister Brad Hazzard is expecting coronavirus infections to increase, but says there are no plans to reimpose restrictions.
Once the unvaccinated are mixing in with the vaccinated, you'd have to expect the numbers will increase even further, and that's worrying because that puts pressure on our doctors and our nurses. We're not about to start backflipping on issues that we've promised the community will do.
Australia is relaxing disease control measures despite rising infections and concerns about the effectiveness of vaccines against the Omicron variant. New South Wales Wednesday recorded 1,360 new COVID-19 infections, its highest daily total since mid-September. Australia has detected about 230,000 COVID-19 cases since the start of the pandemic. Some 2,100 people have died. The health department has said that 89.5% of the eligible Australian population is fully vaccinated. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Kenya's High Court has suspended a government order that required everyone accessing public services and places to be vaccinated against COVID-19 by December 21st. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kenyan High Court Judge Anthony Mrema put a hold on a government directive that will have denied services to unvaccinated persons beginning next week. A petition challenging the rule was filed last week by businessman Enoch Aura, who argued the directive was illegal. Rights group Human Rights Watch has called on the Kenyan government to amend the directive and avoid directives that undermine the rights of the people. Adi Radish Krishnan is an Africa Research Fellow at Human Rights Watch. He says the directive will block millions from accessing essential services.
The requirement would risk the violations of the right to work, right to health, education, and social security for millions. Vaccination coverage hinges on availability and accessibility. And the new measures, as initially announced, could leave millions of Kenyans unable to access these government services, like going to the hospital in person, going to university, or going to an immigration office for their ID card.
Like most African countries, Kenya has seen fewer people coming in for COVID-19 vaccine doses in the past few weeks. In Kenya, 3.2 million people are fully vaccinated and 5.3 million individuals have at least one dose. Radha Krishnan says health protocols should be followed and people's beliefs should be considered on vaccine coverage.
While requiring proof of vaccination may act as a powerful incentive for people to be vaccinated, the way it is carried out should account for the numerous reasons a person may not be able to receive the vaccine in time. And these include social, political, or economic barriers. Any vaccine requirement should be implemented within a broader public health strategy that emphasizes accessibility of vaccines and other preventative measures for COVID-19.
With a population of 50 million, Kenya has received 8 million COVID-19 vaccine doses. This African nation has recorded 256,000 coronavirus positive cases and 5,350 deaths. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Afghanistan's former president says the Taliban, who had already reached the gates of Kabul, were invited inside to stop chaos caused by the sudden flight of U.S.-backed President Ashraf Ghani. In a wide-ranging interview with Associated Press, Hamid Karzai said he requested the Taliban enter Kabul to, quote, protect the population, unquote. He says that was needed to prevent the rampaging of marauding criminal gangs that would take advantage of the security vacuum Ghani's departure had created. Karzai has plans for Afghanistan's future that includes traditional approaches like the loyal Jigar, a ground council of Afghans. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Afua in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. and have a good evening.